Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome, welcome. Well, today we're exploring two great races. Coming up a little after 12:30, we'll explore a story that's 3 million years in the making. National Geographic Channel follows two adventurers as they embark on an ancestral journey across the world in the great human race. We'll be joined live by Kat Bigney. She's an adventurer and primitive survival instructor, and she took this journey on National Geographic series with Dr. Bill Schindler, who's an experimental archaeologist and primitive technologist. First, we're going to explore the fascinating and annual Alaskan test of daring, durability, and dogs. Of course, I'm talking about the Iditarod, arguably the last great race on Earth. The 2016 race begins March 5th, and my first guest has run it twice. Her book is part love story, part adventure, and part inquiry into the mystery of the connection between humans and dogs. As you can imagine, they have to be totally in sync. The book is a memoir of what can happen when someone puts herself in that place between daring and doubt and soldiers on. And my guest, I spoke with author Debbie Clark Modereau a couple of weeks ago. We sat down on the phone and we begin our recorded conversation that we're bringing today to you for the first time when we're talking about how racing the Iditarod became her panacea for empty nest syndrome. When many women face empty nest syndrome, they will, you know, maybe take up tennis or take a class or two. You ended up running the Iditarod, and you weren't a typical, typical musher as we think of. You were, I understand, 47 at the time, your mother of two. You're just 5'2", 125 pounds. And it all began for you with one retired Iditarod dog. So tell us how that began.
Well, that is all true. I adopted a retired Iditarod dog in 1989 when I had just suffered a series of mid-pregnancy miscarriages. I was really down in the dumps. A family friend who had run Iditarod called and said that he and his wife were coming over with a present. And I said, I don't need a present. I'm fine. And they walked in the door a little bit later with this dog. And he knew, our friend knew, that I lived for the outdoors, always had. And he said, you keep him, you return him in a week if you don't like him, but we think he's gonna change your world. And he did. So our kids at that point were 5 and 6, and that dog introduced us to the dog sledding trail. First, he cheered me up. We went out skiing. I mean, that's an understatement. He really pulled me back into life and fun. And so then, 12 years later, both my kids go to college. They leave 22 sled dogs in the backyard. Years of sorrow leaving. And my son had actually completed Iditarod at that point. Under the burled arch, he said to me, Mom, you have to do this. And after 12 years of developing a backyard team, really for the kids, yes, I'd taken my turn on in a few races, and my husband and I and the kids had gone camping. So we were already living the lifestyle, but I had never, ever considered running Iditarod. It was too far, too extreme, too expensive, too time-consuming to fit into my life, where I was working a flex-time job and raising kids and having just this wonderful, wonderful time with kids and dogs. But I thought, I don't like the look of the empty nest at all, and that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to run Iditarod. And so I did.
Well, it's pretty amazing. I would think that looking after the dogs itself is almost a full-time job.
Well, it is. You know, there are 26 dogs out my window right now, and you can tell nothing much has changed. And I would say that's the equivalent of having 6 horses, probably, something like that. That's what people can relate to most when they think of it. So It's 24/7, 365 days of the year, but we love it. You know, we love them. We love going with them. I've got three on the couch right now. It's a little chilly this morning. They're right here. I mean, this is what we do, and we have young people that help us year round. We have a handler, and it's fun to introduce her to the sport. So, you know, we're very happy doing this.
Right. Well, I said at the beginning that you may not necessarily be what we perceive as a typical musher, but is there such a thing as a typical? I've talked with a couple myself and photographers who've been up there, and it seems like they're a very eclectic bunch.
I think you're right. I've never actually been asked that before, but our musher friends are all sorts of things can come in the package of a musher. But the one thing we're all tied together with is in a profound, deep love and commitment to the dogs. There's anesthesiologists that run Iditarod. There are people that have grown up in villages and that know the land better than any of us will ever know, or the Bering Sea coast. There are people from Norway. They're men, they're women. It's a very gender-blind sport.
Mm-hmm.
There are many, many different characters out there, which makes it very fun.
Yes. Now, for those who don't know, the Iditarod is 1,000 miles long. You've actually done this twice. The first time your dogs decided not to run when you were just 200 miles from the finish. Tell us about that, because I know I read that it crushed your confidence and you were really disappointed by not finishing, but mostly you were disappointed by losing that connection with your dogs.
Right. Well, I had never asked my dogs to do anything that they weren't just crazy to do. And that included getting to the starting line of Iditarod. We were very well trained. And a lot of the first half of the race, I was hanging on. I mean, I was worried I couldn't do my job for them in terms of hanging on and, slowing them down so that we would get into a nice pace like you would in any other marathon sport. The Iditarod Trail gets to a point 200 miles from Nome where you go out on the sea ice. You reach the coast, and everything is different there. The wind whistles really high. There's no trees, and there's a 30-mile sea ice crossing outside of Shaktulik. And we got out there one day that's not that untypical of conditions on the coast, but these conditions were extremely foreign to us. The wind was howling. All we could see in any direction was white. And we were 10 days into a marathon, so I'm a little rummy. Dogs are realizing this is a long haul. And we got out on that ice, and they just stopped. Mm-hmm. And my bargain with them is based only on mutual respect and positive reinforcement, and there was no cajoling I could do to get them to change their minds. And we went a little bit further. We stayed at a shelter cabin. I stayed in a shelter cabin for 36 hours, but they were totally intimidated, and I was crushed that we'd lost our shared momentum and our bond. The broken bond with the dogs was about the worst thing that could have happened to me right then.
Right, right. So what compelled you to try it a second time?
Well, I'm kind of a person. I had a deal with my husband that, you know, I would run once if he would promise to run once. And I assumed we would both make it to Nome, no problem. We'd never had any trouble finishing a race ever. And we'd done pretty well for a small backyard dog team. And so when my dogs and I arrived in Nome having been flown the last 200 miles, I wrapped my arms around him and said, next year's for you. And he said, no, you need to finish what you started. And I said, no, this ball game's all yours now. And I really, it felt a little too much about me. I thought, oh, Debbie, you just blew it, and it's his turn, and, you know, let's just move on with this program. Well, only a few weeks later, I was crazy to go again, but it was Mark's turn. I insisted. That wasn't the easiest marital year, but we did just fine. We got through it. He got to know him, and he did not take the complicated dogs, the dogs that I thought were most affected by that shutdown. mostly because they started acting up on him a little bit, and we decided we were dealing with a dog team that really needed some confidence. So we put some dogs that a friend of ours lent us, and they had finished the race before. We put them in his team. He finished no problem. And I went again, but I insisted on taking the group that I went with the first time.
Right. You say you see yourself as a dog trainer and not a human coach, but your husband, I remember reading, had come to you and said, I need your help at some point. And hence the tough marital year, I'm guessing.
Right. Well, he was pretty downtrodden, and I was beginning to think that together we'd made a big mistake. We had a dog team that had gotten confused, and instead of thinking about, equal chances within a marriage, maybe we should have thought about setting the course right with me and those dogs first before Mark took his turn. And I thought for a moment, oh my gosh, now we're going to have two discouraged mushers and a dog team that's really screwed up. We've got to get this right. And he's an attorney. He works full time. So I did a lot of the training. So there came a point, which was quite emotional, and I thought, okay, you're going to have to listen to me because I do know more than you'd know about this. And he didn't resist. He wanted to be coached by me. I just felt I didn't want to be that overbearing, wife. And I also had a little bit of a confidence problem myself. But his trials kind of set me straight. I had been out there, and no, it hadn't ended the way I thought it would, but I knew this team better than he did. I knew what we needed to do. I consulted with some friends and really gave him a training schedule that he agreed to, of course. And he had a really great run, which was fabulous. When he finished, it was really a tremendous accomplishment for all of us, and we all knew that.
Right. I don't think you can go through something like this and not remain unchanged. So I'm wondering, this was you did it twice, really, because you were just 200 miles short the first time. After you've raced that 2,000 miles in total, and the second time you were very successful, how did you feel differently about yourself? Did that confidence come back?
Well, it's interesting. In running the book, I've thought about that a lot. And to get to the finish line on that second race was so deeply satisfying. And I'm the type that I don't take success all that gracefully. I sort of think, oh, well, things went well. I got lucky. But this time, I thought, I'll own this. This is the real deal. We've done something pretty great. But it didn't take me long, and I think I was still there when I realized it was for reasons beyond the glory of the triumph and all that. It wasn't that we got there that mattered so much. I think the real gift of the finish line was relieving me of the frustration and the doubts and giving me a chance to look clearly back at where we'd been and to see that the rough places, whether it was the year when Mark ran and we had to pull it all together, or whether it was returning to Shaq Tulik and saying, I'm done, and shaking hands of children that thought I was a hero and I thought I was such a loser, or the breakdown with the dogs, those were the golden moments. Mm-hmm. Those were the moments where real, true joy and satisfaction are born.
And my guest in this segment is Debbie Clark Modereau. Her book is Fast Into the Night, A Woman, Her Dogs, and Their Journey North on the Iditarod Trail. We'll take a quick commercial break, and we'll be right back and continue talking with Debbie.
We're way up in Alaska, the state that stands alone. There's a dog race run from Anchorage in the Nome. And it's a grueling race with a lightning pace, where the chilly winds do wail. Beneath the northern lights, cross snow and the ice, and it's called the Iditarod Trail. We'll give me a team and a good lead dog and a sled that's built so well.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org. Or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
All right, everybody in the car, let's go. What are we gonna do first when we get there, Mom? Go for a hike?
Sure.
What about canoeing? Can we go canoeing too?
I don't see why.
How long does it take to get to the forest?
It's not that far, sweetie.
Are we there yet?
Yep, we're here.
Already?
It's a short drive from your neighborhood to your naturehood. Visit discovertheforest.org to find a neighborhood park or green space near you. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the U.S. Forest Service.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Join us live every Monday at noon on Alternative Talk 1150 or stream live from conversationslive.net.
Get a grip on life with Alternative Talk 1150.
Back to my home, hey, I can tell my tale. I did a right trail.
And that's just what we're talking about, the Iditarod, today with Debbie Clark Modero. The book is called Fast Into the Night, A Woman, Her Dogs, and Their Journey North on the Iditarod Trail. And here's the rest of our conversation. There's no doubt reading this book just how much you love those dogs. It comes through every single page. I mean, it reads like a love story about your dogs. You also had a lot of challenges. So let's look at a couple of those. I mean, you had injuries, hallucinations, storms, clashing personalities, human, canine, obviously. Not all dogs are going to get along, just like not all people get along. What was the toughest moment for you?
Oh, well, the toughest moment was the breakdown in 2003. There's no question about that.
That was the first time you raced.
Because the only reason I went out there was to go on the ultimate journey with my dogs. So that was a really tough moment. There are lots of small tough moments. I mean, Little Sue was my most dedicated, honest, focused veteran leader. I was depending on her to get us safely through the mountain crossing in the beginning of my second Iditarod. The stakes were high. We had to go through really treacherous territory that we did not have to do on our first run. And she had a slightly sore shoulder when we got to the Finger Lake checkpoint, which is right before that mountain range. And there are veterinarians at every single checkpoint along the way. Right away, I consulted with the veterinarian, and I said, you know, I think she's a little bit sore. What should I do? And the vet went over her, and he said, you know, this is not a big deal, but the trail ahead is super rough. We're getting reports of holes as big as cars out there. You don't want to put her through it. You should leave her here. And so I did. But first of all, there's the sadness of my whole plan and my emotional stability resting on this leader, the
right, right.
The team. And then it just unleashed my doubts of whether I was up to it. And the rest of that race is really the story of me forging the bond with two young new leaders, Sydney and Juliet, who became my leaders of a lifetime, in addition to Sue. But, you know, that was another really, it was a really spiky low moment. It didn't last long. It can't last long. But it did throw me into that. It threw my meter that varies between daring and doubt well down into the doubt stage at a time where I needed to really feel confident. And I got through it. It wasn't all pretty, but I got through it.
Yes, you talk about that several times in the book, that vacillating between between daring and doubt. And you say actually writing the book was a lot like running the Iditarod, because you still had that, you know, that daring and doubt vacillation going on there. So when you were in that doubt position, what was it that got you through? What intrinsically drove you through that? Because a lot of people would have given up.
The book or in the race?
In the race.
What got me through it was just the focus on the present, which is what dogs do. You know, doubt, worry, anxiety, I'm pretty high strung. That's all about things that might happen. And it was just focusing on the present. Right now, we're going down the trail. There's a tricky place coming. I'm ready for it. I look to the dogs. They're happy. They're running smooth. Take a deep breath. Let's go. You know?
Yeah.
And of course, that's what I try to do in life, too. It's not always easy, but it's what I try to do.
Well, I think dogs are
the next important thing.
Yes, I think dogs are great teachers on that, though. That's a thing I've learned from my border collie is live in the moment, be in the moment more, because, you know, it does dispel that anxiety and all these things we do to ourselves.
And things that take you into a place that's so counterproductive.
Yeah.
So, but on the race, there's a lot of sleep deprivation, and in my personality, when I get really tired, I have to really be aware of keeping my focus on the present, because that's one more area. We all have our Achilles heels, and when I get tired, I get insecure, and so, you know, again, but the dogs were with me. Maybe that's why I live so much for them and with them. Maybe it's a personality combination, you know, of what they do so very well.
Right. So I read here your definition. You know you're in love with your dogs, right? But definition of a romantic anniversary present is a new sled handmade by your husband.
Oh, for years, our anniversary, you know, our anniversary is in January because we got married, of course, and high in the mountains in the winter. And he gave me a snow hook for an anniversary present. He built a sled for one. I mean, it was, that was just big stuff, you know. And often he presented them to me at the dog track where we trained. So it became a sort of a ritual.
So let's talk about the dogs a little, because they actually start quite young. You put your pups in a harness around 9 months, and obviously they're not pulling huge sleds at that point, but the training starts fairly young, right?
Yeah, we start training them the minute they're born. We invite little children over here to pat them and play with them. We do everything we can to make our dogs well-rounded, so at the end of their life we can find pet homes for them, and they make fabulous pets. Our dogs have gone all over the country, actually, when they retire, because we just feel like they deserve the very best. But, yes, we put them in harness when they're around 9 months old for the first time. We might run half a mile or a mile, but, you know, there's this term of harness breaking a sled dog. I almost never have seen a puppy in a harness that doesn't just go like crazy. It's like showing water to a Labrador for the first time.
Yeah, it's just inbred into them. And your dogs are Alaskan Huskies. What other types of dogs do really well? They look
Alaskan
very similar to me.
So they're very bloodline. You know, kennel to kennel, they can vary quite a lot or not. Some are houndier than others, but they've been bred for the trail. They have double coats, and they're very athletic machines. And there's scientific research being done on their metabolic talents, and I don't think we understand half of what they can do and how much they can teach us about cold weather adaptation and endurance and stamina. And there's some really great studies going on. There are people that run purebred Siberian teams in Iditarod. They do very well. Of course, in some ways, those were the founding dogs of our sport. They're beautiful. They don't move quite as fast, but they have thicker coats, and there's a lot of advantages to them. A few purebred Malamute teams have come into the race. I'm not sure how many have finished. I think a few have. Those are the big, burly dogs
right.
That you see on TV. I've heard that they get along better with people than they do with each other, and that's one of the challenges. But it's fun to watch them.
And I
went on the serum run with a team of Samoyeds. They're gorgeous. They're down in Washington somewhere, or maybe Oregon. But they're beautiful white dogs with a curly tail, and they had so much fun going to Nome on albeit a more relaxed schedule.
Right, right. And so they will often run until they're like around the 12 mark, because they're not inbred. They tend to live longer, which is a great plus. We've done our dogs a disservice by inbreeding them so much. And they become great mentors then to the pups.
Absolutely, yeah. Right now we have Kanga's pups are now 9 and 10, and actually then some of them are turning 12. And we pair them with our new puppies, who are actually Kanga's great 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 granddaughters, and Kanga is still here. She's influencing Kanga and Sydney both. are here in the genes of all these dogs, and the elders are training the youngers.
Right. Well, we've only got a couple of minutes left here, so let's talk about the book, because I know that too was a labor of love. It's not easy to write a book, and it is really well written. You did a great job with it. And as I mentioned earlier, you said there's an uncanny resemblance between running the Iditarod and completing a memoir. So tell us about that.
Well, I have a problem because I always have to have big goals. And so when I was at the finish line of Iditarod, I knew I was going to write a book. You know, it was my next grand adventure. And I knew I'd lived a story. I wanted to honor the dogs. And I thought it would take me 3 years, maybe at the most, maybe four. And early on, I just wrote and wrote. I've always written all the time, but I started writing a draft. I went to writers' workshops and talked to people who started telling me, people in the industry, editors and agents, and they kept telling me that what they thought my book was about. And after a while, I thought, darn it, this is my story, and I need to learn to write better, and so I can really do it justice. So I went back to school, which was kind of like my return to the Iditarod, and I went to PLU's Rainier Writing Workshop and got an MFA in creative writing. And I'm not saying this to you because you're right there. That program made all the difference. It made all the difference to my writing. It made the difference in my life because I have a new skill that I'm eager to continue to work on a new book now. So yeah. I was indebted to them and a wonderful faculty there and always will be.
And that was Debbie Clark Modereaux. Debbie Clark Modereaux, her book, Fast Into the Night, A Woman, Her Dogs, and Their Journey North on the Iditarod Trail. You can find out more about Debbie and her work at debbieclarkmodereaux.com. And Clark is spelt with an E. It's D-E-B-B-I-E. Clark with an E, Modereaux is M-O-D-E-R-O-W. All right, well, please stay with us. We're going to talk about another race when we come back, and this is the Great Human Race put on by National Geographic Channel. I'm really excited to be talking with Kat Bigney in just a moment, so please do stay tuned. We'll be right back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Rush is on. North to Alaska, I go north, the rush is on. Big Sam left Seattle in the year of
92. Let's see if I guess that this just isn't working.
Knowing you have a great idea for a book is one thing, writing it another. So what's stopping you? Maybe you can't find time. Maybe you don't know where to begin. Maybe you wrote a couple of chapters, then disappeared down a rabbit hole. Or maybe you'd rather someone else write it for you. Partnering with the right coach or ghostwriter can make all the difference between talking about your book and finishing your book. As an award-winning writer and strategic consultant, Vicki St. Clair's storytelling credits span from business, health, self-help, and memoir to New York Times and USA Today best-selling anthologies. Vicki partners with people just like you at the exact level you need. Whether you need a little encouragement, editorial guidance, or full-blown ghostwriting and consulting services. If you're serious about telling the story you know is inside you, stop procrastinating. Let's get your story down on paper. Contact Vicki today. Email Vicki at VickiSt.Clair.com or call 1-800-495-7617. See more about Vicki and her work at VickiSt.Clair.com.
Oh, yeah, that could work.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, Dan Millman, founder of The Peaceful Warrior's Way, shares fresh thoughts around his earlier teachings as well as new perspectives in The Four Purposes of Life, finding meaning and direction in a changing world. Also joining us, Susan Ariel Rainbow Kennedy talks Succulent Wild Love, Six Powerful Habits of Feeling More Love More Often. Tune in every Monday at noon Pacific time right here on Alternative Talk 1150 and catch up with podcasts at conversationslive.net.
It only takes a minute to find out if you may have prediabetes, and you can do it at doihaveprediabetes.org, but you're probably not going to, are you? kids, work, listening to the radio. You're busy, which is great because busy people can't get prediabetes. Oh my, I read that wrong. They can. Should have worn my glasses. So visit doihaveprediabetes.org and take a short test, because prediabetes can be reversed.
Brought to you by the Ad Council and its Prediabetes Awareness Partners.
On the Launchpad Radio Show this week, Zach McMurray, the president of Vitruvian Energy, shares the vision of his clean tech startup and how they have developed an innovative solution to harnessing and producing renewable energy. Chef Dina will share a key ingredient that will give your life a boost. We'll have the latest installment of Delisle's Life Lessons. Jimmy Baca will inspire us with the quote of the week. And R. Hill introduces upcoming events that are on the horizon. Tune in every Wednesday at 8 a.m. Pacific Time, right here on Alternative Talk 1150, as the Launchpad has a blast propelling innovative ideas into a world of possibility. Catch up with producers at thelaunchpad.club.
This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to Anti-Icky Poo, the product that gets the stink out, we cover the world of animals. This week, February 28th, it's a harmonic and energy-shifting Sunday with Jude and Paul Ponton from Whispering Dragon in Seattle. They'll be in the studio with their acutonic forks, Tibetan bowls and bells, pua, didge, and rattles, ready to do remote sessions for you, your animal friends, your home or business. Open phone lines throughout the show, so call in early. Martha Norwalk's Animal World, Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Making a difference, one word at a time.
Ahead of the talk radio curve, naturally. Alternative Talk, 1150.
And welcome back, everybody. Welcome back. As I said at the top of the hour, this next segment is a story that was 3 million years in the making. National Geographic Channel follows an epic journey. It follows two adventurers as they embark on an ancestral journey across the world in the great human race. Now, the new series has already aired. Some of it has already aired. And I was watching this, and it's absolutely fascinating. So I'm very pleased to have one of those adventurers with us. Her name is Kat Bigney. She's an adventurist and survival expert. She is an experienced outdoor survival expert, anthropologist, and primitive survival instructor, and she's been teaching since 2000. She's collaborated with some of the top survival experts in the world and has a degree in anthropology and earth sciences with a focus in archaeology. She's also had extensive remote medical training, and as you might imagine, she has a passion for prehistoric cultures. Let me bring Kat on, and we'll learn more. Kat Bigney, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Vicky. I'm excited to chat with you today.
Yeah, I'm very, I love this kind of stuff, and I was living vicariously. It's much easier from the sofa than what you went through, oh my goodness. But let's begin with the journey so that our listeners know a little bit more about it. National Geographic Channel calls it the great human race. So what was the mission of this program when it was established?
So this is a really complicated program on a complicated project we've been working on for actually a long time. I started talking to National Geographic about it, late in 2014. So we've been on a mission for a while.
Right.
So first of all, we're creating, it's a survival television show, but it isn't. It's complicated because we're doing a lot of research while embarking on this journey, this survival journey, and trying to do work both in the academic field, yet make something that's entertaining. And so I'm working with my co-host is a gentleman by the name of Bill Schindler, and he is a professor of archaeology. And he and I together are sort of solving problems as we go. And we're experiencing these, environments along the way as our predecessors would have. So, we begin this project 2.6 million years ago, roughly, as Homo habilis. So, having a semi-arboreal life in Africa, and the tricky part is both Bill and I are aware that, early humans had the ability to make fire and had the ability, to use stone tools and we used spears for hunting, but Homo habilis didn't. So it was complicated because initially we had to really buy into existing as Homo habilis 2.6 million years ago. So regardless of my knowledge as a survival expert in fire making and shelter building or whatever, I couldn't use those skills. And it wasn't just that I was playing by some weird rules. I really had to buy in, as Homo habilis. So yes, it's a survival component, but we're also trying to fill in the gaps in the archaeological record, trying to understand what happened? Because really, Vicky, like, we have stones, and they remain for millions of years, but that's it. So we don't have a lot of information. So we're trying to experience this to gather information and also to contribute to cognitive archaeology, to understand, you know, what was going through the minds of our predecessors of these early, you know, our early species. And it's, in some ways, it's been impossible, but it's a really cool project.
Yeah, and as you said, it has many layers to it. You know, somebody who's interested in history will just find it equally as fascinating as somebody who's interested in survival. Now, I mentioned at the top of the hour that your partner in crime, if you will, was Dr. Bill Schindler. He's an experimental archaeologist and primitive technologist. So that's a grand name for what, toolmaker? Primitive toolmaker.
If you see, he basically can recreate stone artifacts that you'd find in museums representing, you know, the eras that we were in. And he teaches, he's a professor of archaeology who teaches this stuff. And he and I together, we really made a good team because I have like years of dirt time just doing rough things all over the place, surviving through hellacious winters and horrible storms in my field. So together, it was a really amazing collaborative opportunity and like incredible too. The things, you know, trying to recreate these time periods and to walk as early Homo habilis or Homo sapiens or the experience, you know, to go to environments that could represent what we would have experienced with extreme drought and climate change, what we would have experienced during ice ages and these time periods was just mind-blowing to understand. But what was more complicated than that is that Bill and I are actually representing like a group of people. So the workload involved was intense, and we didn't have, you know, fellow Homo sapiens, Homo habilis or Homo erectus to help us. We had to do this just as two people alone, and it was so overwhelmingly difficult at times. There were so many challenges. We legitimately got roughed up in this project.
Oh my gosh, I could see you were showing some of those scrapes and things. So Homo habilis, they literally survived because of trees, didn't they? They, you know, because of wildlife, they couldn't build fire to keep them away, so they spent a lot of time in trees. And there's one scene in the first episode where you are climbing this tree, which is about 1,000 years old, magnificent tree, and just to get up that tree took a long time. I mean, it was really quite incredible. What was one of the biggest challenges for you on this journey? I know you had many.
Oh,
you have many to pick
biggest,
from.
The biggest, I don't know. This was good, you know, on a personal and professional level for me, because I really had to trust my instincts. I really had to trust that whatever obstacles were, you know, I was presented with, that I would find solutions to. So literally, like, if coming up with solutions to major problems that had huge consequences that we didn't solve on a daily basis. The climbing up the baobab tree was one. So, you know, Bill and I would often just like look at each other and I think, okay, we got to do this. We have no time. What do we do? And just, you know, not taking a ton of time to debate or to question our instincts, but just going. And, you know, it's so much harder. The television program will never show how difficult it truly was for us because we were constantly, you know, without food, without low on water, sleeping out, being incredibly cold, and then oftentimes sick. And, you know, days of you know, low caloric intake really affects your ability, you know, to form complete sentences, for one thing. But to try to make sure that we're not only covering the survival aspect, but for each episode, we're responsible for a chunk of time. So it isn't like we're just playing in the woods and, like, surviving. We have certain bullet points that we have to cover to make sure that we're representing that time period in history. And some of these things are X factors and they're question marks, so we're troubleshooting along the way. And I think just that was the mental challenge. Doing that was harder than starving or being dehydrated or even dealing with cold.
Right. So were you out there the whole time? Because you went to 9 countries. So, I mean, this took a long time. Were you out there the whole time? Did you take a break?
We were typically at a location or moving from one location to another and filming for roughly a month at a time.
Mm-hmm.
So a good amount of time, but we would have I wouldn't call them breaks, okay? Like, in between, like, filming and doing this project, which is also a great thing, we were involved in the research and consulting for this project. So we were deeply embedded. It wasn't like we would show up on location and just, you know, play around. We had a lot of work to do. We would collaborate with you know, Bill and I would collaborate and we'd work with, you know, National Geographic to come up with the important bullet points to make sure that we were doing our homework, that we knew what hazards were in the areas that we're moving in. And we just worked. About a year of nonstop, heart-driven labor to do this.
Right. Well, and you're both experts in your own field. I know Bill has spent years teaching people how to make tools, and it was quite fascinating watching mm-hmm. him pick up two pebbles and make an axe from mm-hmm. it. I mean, really, it was, and mm-hmm. as he said, it's strategic and it's scientific. You don't just bash away to get an axe made. It was really quite incredible. We're going to take a quick break and continue talking when we come back. I want to just touch on a little of your childhood here, because you didn't have a traditional childhood, as we might expect, and I think that would be interesting to our listeners. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, and I'm talking with adventurist and survival instructor Kat Bigney. She is one of two experts who traversed the Earth to recreate the great human race for National Geographic Channel. We will be right back.
Looking for unconditional love, an exercise buddy, or a great listener? Paws has the dog or cat of your dreams, just waiting to meet you. We've made thousands of perfect matches since 1967, because everyone needs a warm, safe place to call home. Find out more today at paws.org or call 425-787-2500.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, Dan Millman, founder of The Peaceful Warrior's Way, shares fresh thoughts around his earlier teachings as well as new perspectives in the four purposes of life, finding meaning and direction in a changing world. Also joining us, Susan Ariel Rainbow Kennedy talks succulent wild love, six powerful habits of feeling more love more often. Tune in every Monday at noon Pacific time right here on Alternative Talk 1150 and catch up with podcasts at conversationslive.net.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair.
Write it down, shout it loud. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM. Now, wasn't that fun?
Welcome back, everybody. Welcome back. Well, today's whole show is about races. We first talked about the Iditarod. We're now talking about the great human race. National Geographic Channel retraces humanity's remarkable journey across the globe in their epic new series. It's absolutely fascinating, and they are following two experts, both experts in their own field, Dr. Bill Schindler, experimental archaeologist and primitive technologist, and my guest today, Kat Bigney, adventurist and survival instructor. And I wanted to look a little at your how you grew up, because I read you spend most of your time in a teepee, which I would love myself, quite honestly. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. Oh, I did have a really atypical childhood. My formative years were, you know, not spent playing Nintendo or shopping. So I grew up in the Rocky Mountains, and my mother, who is a biology teacher, was a biology teacher, decided that she wanted to homeschool her children, and she just loved the world and adopted tons of kids. And I had a different sort of infrastructure. Academics were focused on, but I had freedom, a lot of freedom. So mm-hmm. I would literally, like, you know, walk out into my backyard and it sort of merged with the mountains and just discover. And I was curious. I did have a teepee, and because I had, you know, so many siblings, I wanted some privacy, so I would just stay in my teepee, and have lived in it on and off for, I guess, my whole life. And, you know, I have a grandfather that I really admire. He was a POW for over a year and survived that. So one of the greatest examples of a true survival expert that I know. And then when he returned to the U.S., He became a government wildlife specialist and trapper.
We're talking with Kat Bigney. She is, as I said, taken this epic journey with National Geographic Channel. They went through 9 countries. Let me tell you, each chapter, they took on a different chapter of evolutionary history, living and surviving exactly as humans did back then. So they had to forget all their fire building skills. They had to forget they knew how to survive and just try and recreate the journey as our ancestors did. And they moved from Homo habilis, where humans primarily living in trees, through to Homo sapiens and Homo erectus through until they came to Homo sapiens. But the thing that was really fascinating is just the things that we take for granted every day and we think they're going to be able to, use in the wild. And of course, they had to have this mentality that, hey, I don't know this. Even though I do know it, I don't know it. I have to start from scratch. How would our ancestors have done it? So they started in the heart of Africa. They went through the Middle East. They went through Siberian tundra and Alaska. And finally into what is now the continental United States. And they literally were forced to tough it out along the way. So it's a very interesting program. But I have a couple of questions because we don't have much time left here. And I wanted to just get these. Mm-hmm. One point you came face to face with a lioness. And, as a hiker myself, I've heard so many different stories about what you should do if you come face to face with a big cat. And your reaction was, let's stand here and what?
Well, it was kind of tricky because to be quite honest, believe it or not, I've never had a similar experience to use as a frame of reference. So I don't know lion behavior very well, but this was a lone lioness. So we had happened upon her while hiking or walking through some tall grass, and I thought in that moment, if I run, I'm dead. So she's obviously startled. We surprised her. And so I'm going to bet that she'll retreat. And, from what I've heard, that oftentimes when, lions have their guard down, like when they're consuming a kill or something like that, they often can be chased away, and this is actually a strategy the Maasai use to obtain food. But if they find you or stalking you or startle you, then
it's a different story.
it was a nerve-wracking moment. But after the fact, I was like, oh my god, I'm lucky to be alive. But in that moment, I'm happy that I have the instincts that I do. I don't have. Right. A flight instinct.
Well, that was a good thing in that case. So I know that in the very beginning, it was just a few days in when you were both feeling so weak and dehydrated. You were looking for water. Was there ever a point where you mm-hmm. seriously thought, I really, really can't go on?
No. But I wonder, I think I just have so many, years of experience to know I know my body really well,
mm-hmm.
but I worried about what choices I would have to make if I did hit that point. And I was worried about how close I was getting to that red line, so to speak. So I never, if I would have ever hit the tap out point, I would have. But we were always on the edge. We really were, Vicky. It was just tricky. I never knew. It was always painful and miserable and extreme and way harder than the television show ever show.
Right.
It was rough. And I wonder, I just was so motivated by the project and our goals that I put myself through hell and was willing to. But there were days when I questioned, in fact, the episode that's airing tonight is in the desert, and it was extreme. And it pushed me to a new level of misery for sure.
Well, I look forward to watching you in your misery. Sorry, but it's a fascinating show. I know I have to let you go, but before I do, I know this must have changed you personally in some way. How would you describe that change?
I look at the global community difference, and I really understand the commonalities we have in humanity and how some of the global issues are personal issues for me, that we are a great, you know, human race. And I don't think it's fair to ever isolate yourself and think that someone else has a problem somewhere far away that you don't have to worry about. We're all connected in a greater way than we usually consider.
I love it. That's a perfect note to end today's segment. I'm Kat Bigney. Thanks so much for being with us. Appreciate your time. And you can watch that show. Just check out natgeotv.com, natgeotv.com and natgeowild.com. But just type in National Geographic, The Great Human Race, it pops straight up. And that's airing tonight again, Mondays at 10, 9 Central. And you can catch past shows on the website. Just punch in, it'll tell you what to do when you get on the website. So thanks for being with us today. I appreciate you listening in. And if you have any questions or feedback on today's show, you can find me at conversationslive.net, conversationslive.net. You can also call me at 800-495-7617, 800-495-7617. We're on Facebook at Conversations. Where are we? Facebook. What's Facebook? Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And Twitter at Vicky St. Clair. Getting confused here. And we'll be back next week with an all live new show. So until then, live well, live strong. And thanks for sharing this hour with us.
Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, Dan Millman, founder of The Peaceful Warrior's Way, shares fresh thoughts around his earlier teachings as well as new perspectives in the four purposes of life, finding meaning and direction in a changing world. Also joining us, Susan Ariel Rainbow Kennedy talks succulent wild love, six powerful habits of feeling more love more often. Tune in every Monday at noon Pacific time right here on Alternative Talk 1150 and catch up with podcasts at conversationslive.net.
It only takes a minute to find out if you may have prediabetes, and you can do it at doihaveprediabetes.org. But you're probably not going to, are you? Kids, work, listening to the radio. You're busy, which is great because busy people can't get prediabetes. Oh my, I read that wrong. They can. Should have worn my glasses. So visit doihaveprediabetes.org and take a short test, because prediabetes can be reversed.
Brought to you by the Ad Council and its Prediabetes Awareness Partners.